A very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is numbers 034026 and 034027. Nelson et al. Against John Stewart et al. Counsel, Mr. Kendall.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. In 1988, the Congress of the United States passed an amendment to the Bankruptcy Code, specifically under Section 1114, which presented an option for unions to represent retirees if retiree benefits became the subject of a dispute inside a bankruptcy. The statute did not impose a duty on the union that they had to do it, but gave them a first preference and gave them an option to decline if they wanted to. Moreover, it gave any retiree the option of asking for a different representative if he or she chose to do so. And more importantly, it gave the court, the bankruptcy court, the option of itself deciding to appoint someone else to represent the retirees. In 1998, 3 months after Indiana Steel and Wire entered into a 5-year collective bargaining agreement with the union, the steelworkers, it told the union it was going to renegotiate the contract and would have to file for bankruptcy.
Mr. Kendall, could I just ask if it's a fair statement that the real essence of your argument is that the initial analogy that the district court draws between Section 301 duties of representation and the statutory structure created by 1114 is not a correct analogy, that indeed 1114 is a much more qualified statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we were to find in your favor on that, then at that point, I suppose the next question would be whether one would nonetheless, because of bankruptcy, be in federal court, or whether the kinds of claims that you are attempting to assert against the union would belong back in state court.
The reason I think they would belong back in state court, Your Honor, is because I don't think they arise under Section 114. The rights that we're asserting are not necessarily part of the bankruptcy. They are that the union said there was no negotiation of retirement benefits and they would let them know if there were, and that implicates a state doctrine of great importance in Indiana, promissory estoppel, in which the state has been somewhat of a leader in expanding the scope of it, and secondly, misrepresentation or fraud.
But I guess the thing that interests me is that certainly directly the claims that your clients are trying to bring against the union are not part of the bankruptcy, in that whether you win or lose against the union isn't going to change the size of the bankruptcy estate for the underlying company that was in bankruptcy. But I guess under 1114, your premise must be that if your clients had known during the summer that, in fact, their medical benefits were indeed on the table, and I take it it's your position, although this seems to be a disputed fact issue, that they didn't know anything of the sort. But had they known, they could have used this ability under 1114.1. Capital B to make the motion to get their own claim presented before the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court might have given them some share of the assets, if not medical benefits. Is that how you envision things going if they had gone properly?
It might have gone that way. I would say that, first of all, I think it is almost an undisputed fact that they didn't know.
There's this statement that your opponents point to in Ms. Warner's declaration in paragraph 23, is that right? In paragraph 23, she said she notified Mr. Nelson and Mr. Ellis that the company, ISW's proposals, were containing modifications to their retiree benefits. That's what I'm
Yes, she does say
on.
That. I think there's a second. Our clients universally dispute it, except for one remark on one moment that there might have been a draft they saw, but that gentleman even says that he was told it was not on the table. But she does, in fact, say she told them. They deny it. The only documented evidence that they found out about it is the October 15th notice after everything's closed and voted on. There's a second game at foot here that I didn't even, not that I should, but I didn't even recognize it until further into the case, and that is that the party with whom the retiree's benefits were actually terminated, who became the new employer and the new party in the collective bargaining agreement, was not the bankrupt debtor, ISW, which is what the union people are asking about all the time, and it is not any other creditor in the bankruptcy. It turns out that simultaneously, while the employees were aware that this was going on, that there were negotiations with ISW, but were told by the union and the reps that there was no discussion of retiree benefits, they were actually meetings with third party who was anonymous called Durrell, who ISW had broadly filed a petition with to potentially sell assets to an anonymous third party.
Did they turn out to be the asset purchaser, though?
And they
right?
turned out to be the asset purchaser.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a stretch, because you have to take, and this is just my opinion, of course, but you have to take a situation where the termination of the retiree benefits was negotiated in terms of what de facto and de jure actually occurred, was somebody who wasn't even a creditor or a debtor in the bankruptcy, but simply ultimately made an offer to buy, and the creditors' committee voted to sell it to that person.
But if we have to focus on the moment that the union, moment or moments, that the union failed in its responsibilities, something that would give rise to the kinds of state law theories that you're trying to assert, it seems to me it must be the point, some point that prevented the retirees from taking advantage of their 1114 rights, namely during the summer when everybody keeps telling them, oh, you know, nobody's going to touch your benefits, nobody's going to touch your benefits, whereas in fact, according to obviously the allegations and what they understood to be the case, they were in fact talking about these benefits.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. It did occur during that time period.
Okay.
I would argue that although it occurred during the time period when the bankruptcy was going on, it isn't still arising under that statute.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but somehow I think you need to get beyond the fact that under 1114, in the bankruptcy context, the union has at least a presumptive role as representative of the retirees, just as it does in the ordinary collective bargaining context. And what I'm trying to explore is, are there enough qualifications on that in the bankruptcy context that we shouldn't just import all of 301 law?
I think that there are some other policy reasons not to import 301. And I don't know if that directly answers your question. I think that the policy reasons are that if you import 301 and a duty of fair representation standard, then retirees who have a union are going to be in a position where they have a shorter statute of limitations potentially, and they're going to have a representation at a lower standard of care than any other retiree. And then secondly, there's going to be a disparity between retirees as a creditor and other creditors in the bankruptcy who, if their representative in the bankruptcy, would misrepresent the facts to them or be negligent or actually say things to their detrimental reliance, would have a longer statute of limitations and a separate cause of action. And so it's going to create a very to me, it's so complicated, it couldn't get much more complicated, but it seems to me it's going to create still more complicated problems in terms of parity of creditors under 114 for retirees and then retirees vis-a-vis everybody else. And I think that the other thing here is if one concludes that there's some sort of presumptive duty to negotiate with ISW because that's the creditor, I mean the debtor who's saying, hey, I can't do this anymore, where's the presumptive duty to go out and negotiate with Durrell and hunt them up? And these employees don't even know that's going on until after the fact. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's helpful. I don't know if you want to save any time for rebuttal, but
yes, I do. I see my white light, and before I get any more white hair, I'll go sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kendall. We'll hear now from Mr. Swanson.
May it please the court. There are really two significant issues here. The first is whether or not there is federal jurisdiction over the state law claims against the union. The second significant issue is whether and that was what the district court decided, that there was jurisdiction, that 1114 provided that jurisdiction, and that it was that the action that the plaintiff, the state law claims that the plaintiffs have brought were analogous to duty of fair representation.
Right, and I think that assumption needs to be examined in some detail because, of course, 1114 is something designed to facilitate the bankruptcy process to make sure that the bankruptcy court has before it all claims of potential claimants against the estate, whereas the 301 duty of fair representation arises when a union has been chosen as the representative. There can be dissident employees. Indeed, there can be employees who hate unions, who exercise their Beck rights. There are all kinds of people in a functioning collective bargaining situation. And as you say, it's this so-called complete preemption idea that underlay this removal. But if that analogy doesn't carry over to 1114 in a suit that's certainly not a court proceeding or anything like that under the bankruptcy code, maybe this is just a separate state law claim against the union.
The focus, though, I think what we would argue is that the focus of the Congress in singling out the union for a role in the bankruptcy process was not with respect to all of the other types of actions that occur in a bankruptcy, the dip financing or the claims or sorting out other types of issues. It was with specific respect to a bargaining responsibility. Congress gave in 1114 unions a bargaining responsibility.
But the interesting thing here is Congress does not in 301 say the union is the authorized collective bargaining agreement unless it decides not to be or unless people who don't like the union file a motion and ask for their own separate bargainer. That's completely the antithesis of 301, and yet 1114 has both of those limitations built into it.
1114 certainly does have an opt-out provision for the union, or the parties could go and ask
absolutely
the bankruptcy court
and
to do it.
How can they exercise that right intelligently if the union isn't telling them that there's a conflict of interest between the current employees and the retirees, who, as you well know, sometimes count as, quote, employees and sometimes don't?
Well, there isn't necessarily a conflict of interest.
Oh, sure there is.
It's not necessarily an insurmountable conflict of interest.
Well, but that's a right. different thing from there. Saying that there's no potential, and in this case it appears actual conflict of interest because the existing employees managed to save their benefits to a certain degree, and the retirees don't.
In all collective bargaining negotiations, even if this had been outside of the context of bankruptcy, there is the possibility
but
that the union cannot achieve its ends.
Of course, but that's different. In a normal, ongoing relationship, there is a fairly good reason to believe that the current employees are going to be a rather good surrogate for the retirees because they're all thinking, I'm going to retire someday too. I want this CBA to include certain retiree protections. I just, we don't need to get off into a big discussion about labor law, but my concern is that 1114 is not quite the perfect analog to 301 that the district court thought it was, and if it isn't, a lot of other consequences will flow.
1114 is sparse, and it doesn't say much. It doesn't say anything about union liability at
and
all.
And no court has ever said
it is. It hasn't. This, fortunately or unfortunately, is the first case to bring these complicated issues up. But at the same time, if it were what the Congress didn't do, it didn't say that the court should make bankruptcy court should make a determination of whether there might be a conflict of interest. What it said was the union shall be there.
I understand that, but all I'm saying is if this union, hypothetically, obviously this is all just on summary judgment, so I don't know what the final facts will be, but as alleged in the light most favorable to the retirees, these people were affirmatively misled about what was going on in terms of the risk of their medical benefits being jettisoned. And so they were never in a position to go to the bankruptcy court and say, we're invoking our rights under 1114C1 to ask you please to appoint a different representative to us. That representative might have filed, just like any other unsecured creditor, a claim for a certain money payment, might have done many things, but none of that happens.
They did have it's interesting, and it's in the record, they had bankruptcy counsel throughout the litigation.
Right, but did they know? Why didn't the union see, they were told the opposite. It seems to me their claim anyway, obviously, their claim is that they were told the opposite and were not on notice that they might need to do that.
And in fact, Your Honor,
should you just always assume unions are lying?
You should. If the Congress built in by allowing that by allowing the retirees to seek the appointment of a retiree committee, it allowed them to take a safeguard. And also,
I understand, but so you're saying though that they should have taken as given the fact that the statements they were getting from the union representatives were untruthful.
If the retirees were to want the insurance of participation in the negotiations, that was their option.
But is that what you mean then? That in all cases, retirees should never rely on 1114 for a union to represent them because it's always possible the union might not be?
The union, I think that what I'm saying is that the retirees can reasonably rely on the union, and if the union fails them, if the union were to have done the things that the plaintiffs in this case allege that the union did do, they still have a remedy. They are not without a remedy.
What's
here.
What's their remedy and in what court?
A DFR remedy.
Why is it DFR? Because this is a different statute.
But it arises out of negotiations.
No,
it arises
it doesn't.
Out of
it arises
a bargaining
out of the
context.
Bankruptcy process because well, what they were deprived of was a different kind of right, which is the right to put in a claim in the bankruptcy proceeding.
No, they were never deprived of the right. They always had the right to – retirees would always have the right to put in a claim under the bankruptcy proceedings. And, in fact, the union got them $175,000 worth of pre-petition claims.
I know
paid.
The union got the pre-petition. It's just to wake up one day and decide and discover that you have no medical benefits for the rest of your life is a pretty shocking event for people.
And in fact, if they had felt that the union had failed them and had affirmatively misled them, then what they had the opportunity to do is the same as any other member of a collective bargaining unit
they
does,
are
to
they,
file it.
Do you claim that they're a member of the
no.
collective bargaining
no, they,
unit?
No, they are not. They're former members, but the union's role in representing them is the same as the union's role under 9A in representing bargaining union employees. It's the union has the same responsibilities here, the same duties. And, in fact, other courts, this court recognizes in the Rosetto case.
In 301, it's not an 1114 case. I mean, I'm concerned about superimposing this into bankruptcy.
By analogy, there are the federal law, including this circuit, recognizes that unions can represent retirees. Take this circuit, the Rosetto case.
In general, they sometimes can, because there's usually an alignment of interest between current employees and retirees. Do you think a union could damage the interests of its current employees to help retirees? It's usually not that kind of conflict.
But it may not even be that simple. It's not. It's in this case. Take the facts of this case for example. In this case, the only reason, and this is uncontested at least for purposes of summary judgment, the only reason that the company put took out retiree benefits completely off the table was at the assistance of the secured creditor.
Why does that matter?
It doesn't make any difference what anybody would have done. Retiree benefits were in jeopardy because of an outside influence.
I understand that, but the point is, the retirees, had they been participating in the bankruptcy, could have said there's some, you know, discounted value that we can put on what our medical benefits would have been. That's the amount of our unsecured claim. We'd like to get whatever cents on the dollar you're giving to unsecured credit. You know, there are things you can do in bankruptcies.
And they weren't prevented from doing so.
Well, I think that's the dispute, actually. I think they think that they were prevented because they weren't told what was going on, but we'll see.
If the union is subjected to separate state standards in all 50 states in participating in 1114 negotiations, unions aren't going to serve. Unions are simply not going to serve. They're going to refuse to serve.
You've just said the retirees would probably usually be better off if they didn't.
No, by no means. I think that the retirees can reasonably rely on the unions. I mean, they rely on the unions throughout their careers as active bargaining unit members. They rely on the unions to represent their interests in plan closing situations, to get their claims paid, to get their benefits, to file the suits for retiree insurance benefits. The retirees rely on unions for a host of things, reasonably and effectively. And I think it can do so here. And if not, then it has a remedy by a lawsuit. If I may address the other issue, which is the issue of immunity, in which the district court found there wasn't.
Right, the individuals.
The individuals. There is, assuming that there is a proper claim, that the claims of the plaintiffs against the union are federal claims, there is no reason for the immunity provisions of 301 not to apply. It is true that 1114 doesn't specifically mention immunity. It doesn't specifically mention liability at all. However, the 1114 does not extinguish the parameters of 301. 1114 complements 301. The union is to the extent that the union is involved in representation here, it's doing so because it was a signatory to the collective bargaining agreement that it negotiated by virtue of its 9A responsibilities under the Labor Management Relations Act. The 301 liability itself, 301 immunity itself, 301, the history of 301B has been a series of expansions, from simply that union members are not liable for damage suits brought by employers against unions, to union members are not liable for damage suits brought directly against them, even to actions that are unauthorized wildcat strikes, finally to union officers being immune for representational activities, even as far as union lawyers who represent unions being immune under the provisions of 301B. There is, if the Congress intended, so if the first element here is that the Congress intended to import the 301 history and law and concepts into the bankruptcy context in 1114, then it also makes sense that it intended to import the immunity concepts of 301.
As I understood the history of 1114, it came about after the LTV debacle, where Congress was actually unhappy with the way that normal background standards were operating. Why does that lead us to say, well, they actually just meant to duplicate them?
It wasn't happy about bankruptcy, what was happening in bankruptcy.
Well, that's
not
right.
About
they weren't happy with the way that ordinary union representation was carrying over into the bankruptcy context.
I think, Your Honor, that the history of that case, the LTV case, was what upset Congress was that the bankruptcy law itself permitted, or conceivably permitted, a company on entering a Chapter 11 to terminate, to make these things pre-petition claims and to terminate them. I don't think the history was that they were unhappy with the unions. They were unhappy with the consequences of the bankruptcy law. The court here also focused, and I think erroneously, on whether there is a 301 contract. It's true that under the in the 301B cases, if a union, for example, if union officers hurt an employer with whom they don't have a collective bargaining relationship, you know, let's say a secondary employer, then there may not be immunity. Mm-hmm. If union officers were to hurt somebody who has no connection to the bargaining unit, they get a guard fired during the course of a strike, there may not be 301 immunity. Here, however, there is a collective bargaining agreement. The retirees have their rights, their medical rights, solely by virtue of a 301 agreement. The retirees are connected to the union. They are not a stranger to the union. They are connected by virtue of that collective bargaining agreement. Therefore, the cases of the Third Circuit and the Sixth Circuit that the district court relied on are inapplicable. Here there is this representational activity by the union officers. The union can only act through its officers in conducting the 1114 negotiations. There is the same type, if this had been an action by active members bringing the same state law claims because they were unhappy with the result of 1113 negotiations, it would be clear that the union officers were immune from their conduct, even these types of alleged representations.
But as I understand 1114, it's not there for active members, right?
It's 1113 only, is there for active members.
Yes. About retirees.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kendall.
I think that that perhaps a starting point on the rebuttal here is that there's no statutory evidence that there is a public policy interest in importing 301 into 1114. Because the Senate report says that they're simply trying to protect retirees with union or not, within the context of the bankruptcy law, and any other bigger policy issues should be addressed by other committees of the House and Senate. And secondly, the idea that this would somehow have a chilling effect on union serving, I think, is false. For one thing, we're all here as lawyers with a higher standard of care and subject to malpractice if we misrepresent our clients, whether here or in bankruptcy. And union officials regularly have treasurers and others bonded to protect them in case there's some financial damage. There's nothing to protect them from getting similar bonds if they choose to do this. But moreover, this isn't a situation where these members were forced to bargain because they are the designated exclusive bargaining representative. They've got a contract that says they must represent these employees in the collective bargaining unit, whether they pay or don't pay dues. And they are not negotiating just with somebody under a 301 contract. They are negotiating with a third party who doesn't even have a contract with them. And they're doing it voluntarily. And not only do they do it voluntarily, but they then take on the mantle of actively telling these people that there is no collective bargaining going on about the retirees' benefits. They secondly tell them that if you want to be on the bargaining committee, you can't. Third, if it comes up, we'll let you know. Fourth, you can't sit on it. Fifth, you can't represent yourself. We're going to. And fourth, there's a dispute about this. Our clients say they're told, and don't get an attorney because we're not going to let an attorney come in and do it. The fact that some of the retirees have an attorney because of an ESOP issue is irrelevant, because the fact is that everyone, a retiree, these are being told that this isn't even on the bargaining table. It seems to me that the idea of Congress under 1114 was that there are all these retirees, some with unions and some without. these retirees ought to have some opportunity to get into the bankruptcy. And if you happen to have a union, they can do it for you for free, maybe, if they want to, but we're going to let you have this opportunity to intervene. If that union chooses to exercise that right or obligation or opportunity and then begins telling these people it's not on the table, it seems to me that there is no adverse implication to national labor relations policy that somehow we're going to have a situation where unions who have collective bargaining agreements, who are actively representing people who are members of the collective bargaining agreement or the unit, are going to be adversely affected. This is not the kind of situation that the National Labor Relations Act or LEMRA contemplated. This is a situation where somebody volunteered to be the representative of somebody else. And why? I would suggest that there is a reasonable inference here that the reason they volunteer to do this is so that things don't get more complicated for them. That if they had gone out and told these workers, guess what, your rights are at issue, and they then insist on getting somebody, like a lawyer or somebody else, to come in to represent them, then there would have been a clarification of the conflict. Because when the members start thinking about submitting this to a vote to the members, there would have been a discussion. These retirees weren't even told when the union was voting. They didn't come to the meeting. They didn't get to come to the meeting. And they had no opportunity to do anything to protect themselves. And I apologize if my passion on this is a little great. This obviously has been a big struggle for these workers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kendall. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel for their fine oral arguments today. The case will be taken under advisement.